everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comics Horse Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is a Marvel Monday episode. I'm going to be talking about a couple of Marvel books I've read recently, starting with Avengers No Road Home, number 3. This is written by Al Ewing, Jim Zub, and Mark Waid. We have inks by Paco Medina, colors by Juan Velasco, letters by Jesus Arbatov. And this is continuing the story that we've been talking about on the last couple of Marvel Spotlights, where following the events of the Avengers No Surrender, where the Grandmaster and the Challenger had basically stolen Earth, and then the Grandmaster put his own daughter into play as a supposed long-lost Avenger, and she eventually turned on her father, sided with the Avengers, and once that story was over, she imprisoned the Challenger, far end of the universe, and she was watching there, and she saw this formerly imprisoned Olympian god, Nyx, who, because the Earth got moved, and Nyx was supposed to be imprisoned, you know, as long as the sun shone, and then I guess technically the sun wasn't shining on Earth because the Earth had been moved from its spot in the solar system. So Nyx was able to be freed. She went to Olympus. She exacted her revenge. And then Voyager, you know, seeing this, went and recruited a bunch of Avengers and took them to the ruins of Olympus. But they were kind of outmatched by Nyx. And Voyager teleported them all away, much to the consternation of Hercules, who wanted to stay there and fight her. But Voyager felt it was more important for the Avengers to go out and find these crystals that are shards of Nyx's power before Nyx's children find them. Nyx has sent her children out to find these crystals that contain some of her power so that she'll be even more powerful when she's gathered it all herself. So, you know, kind of a MacGuffin hunt, not the most original idea for a story, but that's what's been going on in the first couple issues. And we did see that Hawkeye last issue woke up in a hospital. He was missing some fingers and wondering what happened. He's full of self-doubt, like, why am I here? And do I really belong on the Avengers? And we saw that the Immortal Hulk, who holds a grudge against Hawkeye for having shot Bruce Banner in the head with an arrow, despite that being what Bruce wanted, the Immortal Hulk still wants to get some revenge on Hawkeye, as it were. So that's kind of where the last issue left off. This one starts with Rocket. Once again, the issue is being narrated by one of the characters. This isn't so bad. This one's being narrated by Rocket, but he doesn't have a lot to say. So it's not like the previous one that Hawkeye narrated was really hard to follow, because you're getting this stream of thoughts from Hawkeye, you know, winding through, but it's hard to keep track of that thread, that, you know, what his the path of his thoughts, if you will, when you're reading the events that are happening on the page as well. So it's almost like you have to read it twice. Not a big fan of doing that. Give us a little narration from a character at first, or give us narration from a character where we don't have to see what the people are saying in the panels, because otherwise the dual narratives gets kind of confusing. But this one, like I said, it's a much less narration from Rocket, and he is having dreams as well, or nightmares, if you will. He's thinking back to when he was first modified by these robots. He talks about Rocket waking up while he was being born again and how it hurt like hell, and maybe it was hell. And again, he's remembering this, and the pain is like an old song played from a memory, we're told. It's deja vu, and, you know, being the Ranger Rocket, he thought he had blocked all this out, but there's a little bit of it still there, obviously. As much as he tried to forget, this is who he was, and he disguised it, the memory of that pain behind sarcasm and snarls. And so he breaks free in his dream or his nightmare from these robots that are, you know, working on him, shooting him with this laser, grabs a laser, fires it at the robots, this surgical laser that goes up to 5,000 degrees, and basically he escapes. So he's running through the hallways, again, remembering what this hospital was like, but everything is not the same. There aren't other animals. There's details that are missing. And he's thinking, where are all my friends that had been here previously? And he goes running through a door, and he actually comes upon the Hulk and Hawkeye. So he's like, yeah, this is obviously not the same place. This is a different sort of dream. And he quickly tells the Hulk to stand down, basically, because the Hulk's got Clint Barton Hawkeye by the throat, you know. And he's like, put him down, Hulk. I'm asking nice here. And the Hulk actually agrees. He's like, you know what? Fine. I don't need to touch him because all I need is time. And he starts taunting Barton. He's saying, you know, that hearing loss, that's just the least of your worries, right? How many years before your aim goes and you're in a real hospital, and before you know it, they're going to be signing the papers to switch you off. And you know where I'll be then? I'll still be around, still be strong, still immortal. And Hawkeye's like, wait a second, this isn't a real hospital? And the Hulk tells him, look down and count your fingers again, right? The fingers you thought you were missing. And he sees that they're all there. And as he realizes that, all of reality warps around. And we see that they are, in fact, they have all been dreaming. And we see Nightmare there on his horse. And he's given his usual spiel, you know, over the top. Yes, you're all marooned in my realm. And I'm your greatest foe, Nightmare, and blah, blah, blah. But the guys, they don't look convinced. It seems like something isn't quite what it seems. They have their suspicions. Meanwhile, the rest of the team, as it were, Hercules, Monica Rambeau, Vision, and Scarlet Witch, they've been transported somewhere else. And they're trying to figure out where exactly they are. And so they kind of look around. Nobody recognizes it. And then there's a light that shines on them. And Hercules says, oh, now I realize where we are. We are in the Omnipotent City, where no mortals have ever been before, and we need to press on. And Wanda, Scarlet Witch, who had her eyes kind of infected, if you will, by Nyx at the end of the first issue, like Nyx literally stuck her hand through the back of Scarlet Witch's head and two of her fingers came out through her eyes, and she's been blind ever since. She's like, I can actually see something for the first time. There's something glowing out there. And Vision's like, well, can you be more specific? She's like, no, it's a shape. It's burning in the dark. It's the only thing I can see. And Monica Rambeau, Spectrum, she says, well, let me go scout ahead and see what it is. And Hercules is like, no, don't. It's too easy to lose yourself in here. This place is myth. It's not science. There's no coincidences or random events. Everything here is fate. And we got to stick together. Voyager must have sent us to find, you know, whatever, and maybe that's what that glow is, but we need to stick together so we can find whatever it is that we need to find, and I can visit my wrath upon Nyx and her children. So meanwhile, back in the hospital, or what was formerly the hospital, but is Nightmare's realm, Nightmare's saying, you got to do what I tell you, otherwise I'll visit horror upon you. And Rocket's like, what's going on with this guy? You know, Nightmare's pretty powerful, but he sounds like he's trying to convince us that he's got power, not actually showing us. So what's exactly he trying to sell? Why does he need our help if he's so powerful? So Rocket basically says, you know, calls him out on it. Like, if you're so powerful, why do you need our help? And how come I could break out of my dream and break into their dream? Like, what's going on? And Hulk's like, yeah, he's got a point. And he starts heading toward Nightmare, and Nightmare's like, stay back, stay back. You know, I'll smite you, basically, is what he's saying. And Hulk's like, I don't think so. And he reaches for Nightmare, and Nightmare kind of collapses. He's like, okay, you know, you got me. And he kind of shrinks down, looks like a smaller version of himself. And he's like, obviously, I'm me, but I'm very weak. And the Hulk's like, yeah, I figured as much. So start talking. What's going on? So Nightmare starts telling him a story that long ago he'd made an agreement with Zeus that he was going to hide a crystal in his realm, the crystal being called the Night That May Not Yet Be, which is basically, it's one of those crystals that houses some of Nyx's powers. And in return, Zeus and his people would leave Nightmare alone. And for thousands of years, that's how it worked. Nightmare kept the crystal safe, and the Greek gods never bothered him. Until recently, when one of them did. And it's actually one of Nyx's children, Hypnos, and she's been battering at the walls of Nightmare's castle, and it has weakened him. all of the sort of minions or army of Hypnos. They're already asleep, so Nightmare can't affect them, and his powers, you know, vastly weakened. He doesn't have the dreams that he normally can draw on. You know, there's not as many dreams for him to draw on to get his power. So Rocket Raccoon's like, well, so you ran? He's like, well, no, I'm still there in the castle, but I'm also here. It's a metaphor, like everything in dreams, but you know, the walls are eventually going to crumble. And when they do, Hypnos is going to have the crystal and everything else that was mine. And I'm too weak to stop him. And Hawkeye's like, but not too weak to torture us, right? You could have just asked for our help. And he's like, well, I'm not one to beg. Don't you understand the humiliation, right? To need help from mere mortals. This is actually my nightmare. And so Clint's like, well, you know, we're going to help you. We can't let Hypnos get his way. And Rocket's like, hold on. Speak for yourself, Captain Pointy Sticks. And he says, this guy was just torturing us, and now he wants my help. I got two words for you. Pay me. And Hawkeye's like, hold on. That's not how we operate. Hulk shoves him aside. You know what? I've had run-in with real Avengers, Barton, and you're not one of them. So shut up. The adults are talking. And he goes up to Nightmare and says, yeah, Rocket's right. You want my help, it's going to cost you. And Nightmare's like, I told you my power is severely limited. What can I possibly offer you? What do I even have left? And the Hulk gets a little bit of a smirk on his face. And Rocket's like, uh-oh. You know, I knew the Hulk back when he was stupid. And now with that look on his face, Hulk may be the only one who is happy to be in the situation that we're in right now. So meanwhile, back in the Omnipotent City, Spectrum, Hercules, Vision, and Wanda are walking through the city, headed toward that bright light they saw. And Spectrum's asking Hercules, you know, have you been here before? He's like, yeah, the city of the Infinity. It's the nexus of the gods, and you're all actually lucky to be here, that you're the first immortals that have ever even set foot on this place. And as they enter this library, we see the librarian show up and he basically calls Hercules on that, like, yeah, how dare you? How dare you bring these mortals here? You know, they don't belong, what have you. And Hercules says, well, you know what, good sir, we don't have any time to waste. And he starts to introduce himself, and the librarian says, I'm familiar with you. These halls are all knowing, right? There are no surprises here, so you don't need to explain. And Hercules is like, okay, well then, if you know why we're here, you know we're not here out of any malice. Apparently my father entrusted you with the safekeeping of a fragment of power. You know, we need to know where it is. And the librarian says, all knowing and all telling are two different things. And I realize that Nick's intends to come for the night that was, but I've hidden it, and that's all you need to know. And Hercules says, well, if you think you can stop her from taking it, you're wrong. She massacred gods, hundreds and hundreds of immortals. So you need to call up an army to stop her if she comes to try to take the crystal. And the librarian's like, no, gods war among themselves all the time. We have the parliament, you know, we hold ourselves above that. And as Scarlet Witch is watching this, she's using that sight that she still has, and she sees that the crystal is actually around this librarian's neck, and it's being hidden by his beard. And she says, I got it, Hercules, it's right there, the fragment, it's around his neck. And at that moment, we realize that Scarlet Witch wasn't blind at all. She was seeing through Wanda's eyes. That's what she did when she stuck her hands through. So as soon as they find the crystal, here come a couple of Nyx's other children, Apate and Dolos, and they start attacking our heroes. So the one of them basically can she throws daggers, and they cut through flesh, and they can sort of manipulate people, manipulate their emotions, kind of gain control over them. It kind of infects them with lies and half-truths. And Dolos has this fog that can sort of corrupt everything that it touches, and it provides cover, obviously. So Apate throws her daggers at Hercules and infects him. And the librarian's, you know, explaining to the other Avengers, yeah, her daggers can cut through flesh and through reason and through sanity. And sure enough, as these daggers embed themselves in the back of Hercules, he says, no, Librarian, I can finally think clearly. The Avengers failed to save Olympus. They're the ones responsible. It's their fault. And the last son of Olympus is going to balance the scales by killing them all. So clearly that's not logical. You know, in no way is it the Avengers' fault that the Olympians fell. They all fell before they even knew anything was happening. But that's what Apate's daggers do, right? They twist everything around in Hercules' mind, so he's going to attack his own teammates while Apate and Dolos try to get the crystal from the Librarian. So really fast-paced issue. Not sure what the Hulk might want from Nightmare. Not sure how Nightmare can be of help since he's so weak, and you know, he himself said that. And it's an interesting dynamic, the fact they put Hulk, Rocket Raccoon, and Clint Barton together. Poor Clint, you know, he's by far the weakest Avenger, which is why he was having all those doubts last issue. But he's got no chance to control Rocket or the Devil Hulk. I mean, zero chance. It's those three together, that's just the Wild West, you know, with Clint just trying to keep up and keep his head down and survive it. The other team's a lot more powerful, but with Hercules turned against them, obviously they're going to have their work cut out for them. And we also know, we saw in the first issue, that they're working on Vision. He's having some sort of mechanical breakdown. And we do see a moment in this issue where he tries to talk and he kind of stutters, and the others are even worried about him. Spectrum's like, Viz, are you all right? Your systems are deteriorating. And he says, yes, but we'll persevere. Just a minor variance. I'm rerouting neural pathways to compensate. So I imagine his system failures are going to get worse as the story goes along, and he may have some trouble helping out. And we don't know how much Scarlet Witch has been compromised. You know, she's obviously a very powerful member of the Avengers, but if she's compromised beyond just Nick's being able to see through her eyes, that can be a problem as well. But all in all, a solid issue. This is the first issue where I kind of feel like we're getting some traction and the story might be kind of interesting. I'm not a big fan of Hercules or Thor or any of the kind of mythological characters of the Marvel Universe. They sort of bore me. And I don't know why that is. It's kind of the same a little bit on the DC side of things with Wonder Woman and such. When we start talking about these gods, whether they be Greek gods or Roman gods or whatever, it just, I don't know, maybe it goes back to studying mythology in college and how boring I found that. But it's never held much interest for me. But I feel like after the first two issues, now we're actually getting into some superheroics and some fighting and stuff. And maybe we'll get some good comic book story here, because it's been a little slow so far. The art for the most part is pretty solid. The colors by Juan Velasco is a little more muted than I'd like for a story that's supposed to be high superhero adventure. I'd like them to be a little more primary. But the art for the most part is pretty good. If there's anything I don't care for, in the Paco de Medina artwork, is he's very inconsistent in how he draws Scarlet Witch. Like, sometimes she looks like she could be, I don't know, 16. Like, she looks just like a little girl. And then other times she looks much, much older. So I don't know, maybe he's just having a hard time getting some consistency with Scarlet Witch. Not real sure what the issue is, but overall the art is pretty solid. All right, well, let's move on to the next book I'm going to talk about. It's Daredevil number 2. This is the 2019 series by Chip Zdarsky. Art is by Marco Cecchetto. Colors by Sonny Go. And this is and letters by Clayton Cowles, I should say. This is No Fear Part 2. So we did see in the last issue how Matt had gotten back out on the streets in his Daredevil costume, and he felt he was rusty. Still hasn't fully recovered from his stay in the hospital when he got hit by the truck. And he ended up going against just some garden variety robbers. You know, these guys like knocked over a liquor store or something, and they almost beat him. They almost defeated Daredevil before he took them out. And then as he went back to his apartment to recover, there was a news bulletin saying that one of the robbers that Daredevil had subdued had died of his injuries. So this issue starts off, we see Detective Cole North, who we also met last issue, this new New York detective who just transferred from Chicago, who for some reason has a personal vendetta against Daredevil and wants to bring him to justice. And he's working out on a heavy bag in the gym at the police station. There's a couple of other police officers watching him. One of them's his new partner, and the other's saying, okay, well, I guess good luck. What are you guys working on? He's like, you didn't hear? We're going after New York's most wanted killer, which that currently is Daredevil. So Foggy Nelson has also seen the news, and he's worried about Matt and has been calling him repeatedly because he's worried, and he's thinking, if Daredevil's a murderer, I got to help him, and maybe I can convince him to turn himself in. Meanwhile, Matt's thinking, you know, the cops worked the crime scene and the rubber was declared dead only half an hour after he gets to the hospital. There's got to be something going on because I don't kill. You know, I know the human body and I use my senses and you know, somebody's setting me up. So he actually, as Foggy's calling him again on the phone, he shows up at Foggy's office. And Foggy's trying to convince him, hey, you know, you need to turn yourself in and we can, you know, figure it out. Maybe they'll even let you, you know, keep your mask on. And Daredevil's like, no, I didn't do this. It has to be Fisk or somebody else pulling strings to make me look dirty. You know, I knew that Fisk cheated to win the election. I was right about that and I'm right about this. Well, he's like, look, man, you got to turn yourself in. You testified as Daredevil before, but this is, you know, beyond that. And Daredevil's like, no, I'm not going to do that. And Foggy's like, well, at least lay low, like put the costume away for a while. Everybody's looking for Daredevil. Nobody's looking for Matt Murdock. And Daredevil says, no, I can't do that either, because if I go into hiding, it looks like I'm guilty. So if anything, the costume stays on and people need to see me. I'm Daredevil and I'm innocent, and he leaves. Meanwhile, at the hospital where the guy was declared dead, we see a couple of doctors there. The one that actually tried to help the guy goes outside for a smoke, and Daredevil confronts him and says, what did you do? That thief, quote unquote, died under your watch. Tell me what happened. And the doctors, you know, he's scared. You know, all of a sudden Daredevil could be a murderer for all he knows. And Matt's listening to his heartbeat and he's saying, look, I told the police everything. He came in with a head injury. It was at the base of his skull. We did everything we could. But we tried to rush him into surgery, but it was already too late. And Matt's thinking, man, he's terrified. I can smell it. And his heart's pounding, but it didn't skip a beat. Like what he's saying is not a lie. And the doctor's like, look, as Daredevil lets him go, he says, this man's dead because of you. And if you came here to try to blame somebody, you know, that's not going to happen. You know, we do our best to save people, but you know, we're not always successful. And that man was going to die no matter what we did. And, you know, we've patched up tons of guys that you have sent our way, as it were. And everybody knows how precise you are. Like, you're surgical. You know just how much damage to do to these people so that we can, you know, make sure they recover from their injuries. And I don't know how you do that. I don't know how you know their body so intimately that you know just how much pressure and just where to strike. But trust me when I say this, you screwed up this time. And this guy's dead because of you, and you need to stop with the violence. He's like, there are other ways to help. I mean, with your abilities, and Daredevil doesn't want to hear anymore. He swings away. And the doctor is looking after him saying, you should have been a doctor. So meanwhile, at City Hall, North and his partner have gone to see the Kingpin. And the receptionist doesn't want to let him in. She's like, I'm sorry. I know you might be police officers, but there's nowhere in the schedule, and they just walk right by. They're just like, wait, you can't just like, yeah, we can. And North is thinking about how his partner Higgins is not the best cop. He's competent. He took a bullet a few years ago. But all North cares about is he's not dirty. Like when he got this job with the NYPD, that's all he asked of the captain. Just give me somebody who's not dirty. And so he's got this guy to watch his back, this Detective Fred Higgins, but he doesn't really trust him or think that highly of him. And he's like, you know, he seems calm now. And I know I seem calm. I always look calm, but I'm not. I just look it. Inside I'm screaming. And it's not with fear, it's with anticipation, because how often do you come face to face with Wilson Fisk, right? The most powerful man in New York City. So they go walking into his office, kind of barging in to the Kingpin's office. And the Kingpin's like, oh, you know, I was expecting you. He knows all about them. You know, you're Cole Norris from Chicago. And North is like, huh, it might not be fear that sends a shiver up my spine right now. You know, hearing the name Wilson Fisk and hearing him say my name, it's got me off balance a little bit. I need to focus because, you know, he once was the kingpin of crime, probably still is. And all the cops dreamed of putting this guy away. And now he's the mayor. So he knows something is not right here. So he's basically there just to kind of feel the kingpin out. He's like, I won't take up much of your time. I'm sure you heard about the homicide with Daredevil being the suspect. And, you know, of course, Kingpin playing it off. Oh, yeah, that was just tragic. And I assume you're here because of my history with Daredevil. And Norris like, yeah, you guys have an antagonistic relationship. And since you've been adamant to try to bring him to justice, we just thought that we would check in. And Kingpin says, oh, that's very admirable. But I certainly haven't seen him. You know, I know Daredevil's out there trying to find out who set him up, but you know, I didn't have anything to do with it. And they're like, okay, well, Mr. Mayor, we're going to assign some detail to you, some extra protection, because we don't think anybody should be above the law. And he pauses and then says, Mr. Mayor. So there's definitely some insinuation there. And the Kingpin says, okay, you know, that's fine. And if that's the case, you could have just called, you know, if you wanted to let me know that, but you didn't. And I know why. It's because you're curious, right? You wanted to see me for yourself. You came all the way from Chicago, right? Leaving your life behind, your friends, poor Anna, who we don't even know who Anna is, but you know, it's the Kingpin. He knows everything that goes on in his city. And he says, okay, gentlemen, if that's everything, I have a city to run. And Norris thinking, he's not going to rattle me. I'm not going to let him, but he's right. I wanted to see him and smell him for myself. And he smells like aftershave and meat, but he's just a man. And once I arrest Daredevil, Wilson Fisk is next. So the cops leave. And the Kingpin's assistant, Wesley, apologizes, saying, I don't know how they got up here. And he's like, no, I wanted them up here. I wanted to meet the fine officers of the city. They're the real heroes. So clearly he knows that North may be a problem. He wants to keep an eye on him, basically. North wanted to size up the Kingpin. The Kingpin wanted to size up North. So mutual meeting there. And meanwhile, Wesley's like, you know, I hate to ask this. You know, I don't need to know all of your moves, but are we involved in this Daredevil business somehow? And the Kingpin says, you know, Wesley, I really loathe Daredevil. He's a man who causes me no end of grief. And if I had anything to do with this situation, I would be bursting to tell you, but sadly it wasn't me. And as the scene pans back outside of City Hall, we see Daredevil's been eavesdropping, has been listening to Wilson Fisk's comments. And just like before with the doctor, there's no skipping of the heartbeat. And so it appears that Daredevil, or Kingpin rather, is telling the truth as well. So next we see Matt head to a church. He's looking for Father Simons to sort of confide in about what's been going on, but he's not there. But Sister Elizabeth is, and they chat for a little bit, and he talks about how, Matt talks about how he feels like he's being tested, and everybody thinks he did something unforgivable, and Sister's reminding him that, you know, nothing is unforgivable as long as you repent. And Matt says, yeah, I know that, but all I ever wanted to do was help people. And Sister says, well, it's simple then, right? Then go and help people. And he realizes that she's right. You know, he's been going around trying to figure out who set him up rather than just doing the things that Daredevil does, which is stop crime and keep people safe. So that's what he does. He gets out there the next night, and he's visible as Daredevil, and he's helping people, and he's saving lives. But what he realizes is that as he's saving these lives, the criminals are afraid of him, but the victims that he's saving are just as afraid. And he's worried. You know, he's like, I didn't kill Leo Carrero, but all everybody sees is the dead man, and they see me in this red suit with horns covered in blood. And I can tell Foggy doesn't believe me that I didn't do this. And if Foggy doesn't believe me, how can my oldest friends believe me? Like, how am I going to be able to convince them, you know? And we see Luke Cage and we see Jessica Jones, and they're all worried about it. And they're looking at the headlines. And Matt's also thinking, and are criminals going to fear me now? Or is it worse because they're all going to band together and the stakes have been raised? You know, now they think it's life and death. So if this wasn't Fisk who set me up, then who? Who was it? There's got to be something that I'm missing. So he decides to go back to the crime scene to see if there's anything there that can help point him in the right direction. When he gets there, he's concentrating, trying to see if there's anything that he missed. And he's like, it's hard to even concentrate over the smell of the burnt and waterlogged building material and torched alcohol. And it's too, he's like, it's too much. I can't pick up anything. And then as he's concentrating so much, it allows Detective Higgins and Detective North, who are also coming to the crime scene to do another once over, get right up on him. And they both pull out their weapons, and Daredevil manages to throw his billy club at Higgins and knock him off balance. But North manages to pull out his gun and shoot Daredevil, and he collapses there on the ground, and North calls it in, saying, you know, we need an ambulance at 10th and 54th. The suspect known as Daredevil has been shot. So that's where it ends. Daredevil going to be in custody? Is he going to go to the hospital? What's going to happen next? Is he being set up? Did he really, lose control? You know, he was fighting for his life. I mean, should be self-defense, really. I mean, he was trying to stop those guys from, you know, robbing the liquor store. But I guess the law is kind of murky, but it's going, you know, it's showing that Matt is not, all the way back yet. And the stakes are certainly high. And what this Detective North is, and who, you know, who he is and why he has such a chip on his shoulder for Daredevil, I'm sure we'll find out. The art by Chichito is really good. Great line work. It's definitely urban in style, not real inventive when it comes to page layouts. I mean, everything is a triangle or a rectangle, and there's a few insets here and there that work really well, and I wish he did more of it. But we'll see if he can kind of grow. You know, that's an area for improvement. It's a nitpick because the line work is done really well, and he does move the camera around relatively well in the panels as well. There's some great scenes of the New York skyline and things like that. So yeah, like I said, it's a minor nitpick about the panel layouts on the page. Overall, the storytelling and the art is done pretty well. The line work's good, anatomy's good. I can't really complain about any of that. So all right, let's go ahead and move on to the next Marvel book. This is Fantastic Four number 7. It's written by Dan Slott. We have art by Aaron Cooter with John Lucas. Colors are by Marte Garcia with Rochelle Rosenberg. And letters are by Joe Caramagna. The art, it's very recognizable as Aaron Cooter. It's just got that certain look. It's Aaron Cooter's art, if you haven't seen it, it's sort of hard to describe, but it is distinctive in its own style. He has a medium line weight. He doesn't vary his line weights a lot. And it's got just a hint of this cartoonish look about it. And I actually really, really enjoy Aaron Cooter's art. Usually it's a little more detailed than it is here. But that might be, you know, the John Lucas assist. So the colors are very bright, as they should be on a Fantastic Four book. You know, a Fantastic Four book is as much about adventure as it is superheroing. So that always is important in my mind, that Fantastic Four books are very brightly colored. This issue takes place at night, but even so, the colors are still relatively bright. So we know that the Fantastic Four last issue went to Latveria. Galactus has come back to Earth and chosen Latveria to be the place where he's going to attack. And despite Doom saying, "I got it under control, nobody come here and try to help us on pain of death," the Fantastic Four felt it was their duty to try to help protect the Earth and go help out Doom. So the issue actually starts off, and Doom is remembering on this very mountain where they're battling Galactus. That's where he was found when his father had to flee from the Baron's men who were after Von Doom. So the Baron's wife fell ill, and none of the physicians of the court were able to heal her. So they turned to the gypsies, you know, who they always sort of persecuted and put down. But the Baron was desperate and willing to try anything. And so he went to Doom's father, who was the healer of the Romani tribe. And of course, when she died anyway, despite Doom's father's best efforts, then it wasn't the fault of any of the learned physicians of the court. No, it was the fault of Doom's father. So Doom took his son, Victor, and fled and was hiding out on this mountain. And that's where his father eventually died due to the extreme conditions, having wrapped his son in all his clothing so that his son would survive. And so now Doom is sort of trying to do the same thing here, right? He says, "It was my father's final act on this earth to sacrifice himself on this mountain to save me. And now tonight in the same woods next to that same mountain, that sacrifice is going to be repaid." So we see Galactus there. He has Victorious, who is Doom, the woman who is sort of Doom's champion, the Latverian champion, who Doom has imbued with power cosmic, and she's sort of the superhero mascot of Latveria. And what we learned last issue was that Doom basically, by imbuing Victorious with this power cosmic, he created a lure for Galactus. And Reed is like, "Wait a second, you lured Galactus here? You endangered Victorious, Latveria, the entire Earth because you wanted Doom to come here? And like, there's too many variables. Why would you do that? You can't have accounted for all those variables." And Doom's like, "Well, maybe you couldn't, Mr. Fantastic, but of course I can." So Doom has a plan. So this has all been set up ahead of time as Galactus is trying to extract the power cosmic from Victorious. Doom brings up these remote cannons. He calls them Big Bang cannons. They're singularity disruptors, and they're all firing at Galactus and wreaking havoc with his subatomic structure. And while that's happening, he wants Johnny and Benjamin to knock Galactus off balance. And in the meantime, the Invisible Woman can protect all the nearby citizens, their homes and villages and whatnot, because they can't fire these cannons for forever. And he wants Reed Richards to think up some other ideas just in case as a backup plan. So he tells Susan that, "Yeah, the blowback from my cannons is quite severe. I may be putting my subjects in danger. Please, you know, protect them." And of course she's going to do it, but she's like, "Man, you got to be kidding me." She's bringing or Doom's bringing all this potential danger onto his own citizens, and then he expects us to protect them. And meanwhile, not only that, but there's camera robots flying around broadcasting this all around the world, so Doom can try to look good to the outside world. And we do see a few people watching, and they have various opinions on whether the Fantastic Four should have gone and helped or not. And even back in Arizona, because remember, right before this event, I guess you'd call it, happened, right before Galactus came to Earth, it was Ben and Alicia's wedding when Galactus attacked, and Reed rather even paused time so they could finish the wedding, had a little time bubble there so they could finish the wedding before they ran off to Latveria to try to help Doom stop Galactus. So back at his Aunt Petunia's house, at Ben's Aunt Petunia's house, his uncle Jacob's about to cut into the wedding cake, and his aunt's like, "Don't you dare." And she's like, "Well, it's a perfectly good wedding cake. I don't want it to go to waste. Alicia won't mind." She goes, no, it's fine. Just make sure we save a little bit for Ben, Sue, Reed, and Johnny." And Wyatt Wingfoot is there as well. And they say, "Let's go check in on the kids, you know, Valeria and Franklin, and make sure they're okay." Now, Franklin and Valeria wanted to go with the Fantastic Four, but of course they said, no, stay with your Aunt Petunia. Everything will be fine. And when Alicia and Wyatt go to check on them, they're not in their beds. They've snuck out. So kind of what you'd expect them to do, actually. You know, they've been part of the Future Foundation. They've been all across multiple dimensions and the multiverse. They're not used to sitting on the sidelines. And they find them in the garage. They've taken apart their uncle's truck. And they're basically building a transporter so they can teleport to Latveria. And Wyatt and Alicia are like, no. Go back to bed. And in the morning, first thing, you're going to put that truck back together. And Valeria is like, I was going to put it back together. In fact, I was going to make it better. I was going to make it fly. Like, no flying trucks. Just go to bed. And I'm like, man, Aunt Alicia, when did you become such a buzzkill? And she's like, oh, man, kids, right? So they head back to their room as Alicia's like, man, if Ben and I have kids one day, it's tonight was a good reminder they can be little demons sometimes. And we get a little peek into Franklin and Valeria's bedroom through their window, and we see outside their window there are what looks to be a couple little demons. So I'm sure that's the next adventure on tap after we get done dealing with Galactus. So back in Latveria, Ben is hurling boulders at Galactus to try to distract him while Johnny's attempting to free Victorious from Galactus's grasp. And they're sort of running out of time. Ben is running out of boulders to throw. Johnny doesn't seem to be able to do enough to distract Galactus, so he decides to go all out. And he basically flies in front of Galactus's face and goes Nova. He says, you know, all of the Fantastic Four are powered by cosmic rays, you know, the power of cosmic as well. And when I use an all or nothing Nova blast, I do hit the power cosmic level, even if it's only for a second. So when he does that, it does manage to distract Galactus long enough to drop Victorious. But Johnny drops too, right? He just basically used his supernova and lost all his power, burnt it out for a few minutes at least until he can recover. But Victorious, just as he planned, just as Johnny planned, Victorious is able to snatch him out of the sky before he hits the ground, and says, "Okay, I've got you. Pretty cocky, right? But I just saved you, so don't think I owe you anything." So now that Galactus has absorbed this power cosmic from Johnny, he's like, "I'm almost there. I'm almost at the power level I need to be." And at that point, the thing renews his attacks, punching him in the knees, trying to knock him over. And Galactus is like, "Man, you're such a gnat. You're such a pest." And he starts firing the power cosmic itself directly at the thing. And Doom's pretty impressed. He's like, "Man, by all rights, Benjamin Grimm should be dead. I guess I've underestimated him. How's he still standing?" But Sue sees it as well, and she's worried that Ben's not going to be able to withstand it for long. So she goes and throws up a force field that keeps the power cosmic from doing any damage to Ben. And he's like, even though he says pretty confidently, I was fine, I could have taken it. He the word balloons and the shape of the word bubbles, they don't instill me with a lot of confidence. He definitely was feeling it, as it were. So as Invisible Woman is holding up that force shield, and she's starting to show some strain, she yells out, "Hey, Reed, any time now?" And Doom's saying, "Yeah, can't you think of anything, Reed? Must I think of everything? You're Reed Richards. Do something brilliant." So he heads off. Reed Richards heads off. It's like, what can I do? What can I do? Oh, I'm completely empty-handed, one-on-one against Galactus. Oh, that's exactly what I'll do. So that phrase empty-handed made him think of something. So we see that Doom was just trying to get rid of Reed, because as soon as Reed leaves their little flying platform, he goes, "Oh, last I'm left to my own devices. Reed Richards no longer looking over my shoulder. Victorious is there." And she says, "I have Johnny. What should I do with him?" Doom says, "Forget about him. Not important. But you're my champion, Victoria, so be ready. You still have a crucial part to play." And meanwhile, Reed is confronting Galactus, and he has used his his stretching power to basically reshape his hand to look like it's the ultimate nullifier, and confronts Galactus by saying, "Hey, we had an agreement, right? You're going to leave this world alone, or I'd use the nullifier on you. So what are you doing here?" And Galactus says, "Well, that's true. But I'm here because I was compelled to come here. I need more energy. So bring it forth." So meanwhile, Victorious attacks him at that time, and they're actually able to knock him down. But as he falls, he doesn't fall onto the mountain. He falls through it somehow. And now we find out Doom's true purpose. He says, "All of you bear witness. It's a big victory for Latveria and for Doom." And Ben's thinking, "Hey, I may not know much about subatomic what's-its, but I know colors, and he's still purple. So why are you making him out to be this great thing? Like, what is going on here?" And Reed's like, "Yeah, why is he phasing into the mountain rather than, you know, falling on top of it?" And Doom says, "Well, here's a parting gift." And he tosses Johnny at their feet and says, "I want you all to hear me, right? I've been honest with you, sort of. The universe is safe from Galactus, which is what I promised. But more importantly, Latveria is about to reap the benefits, because I'm going to harness the force of nature that Galactus was, and he's going to become the greatest energy supply the world's ever known." So Doom's whole idea of attracting Galactus to Earth was to then defeat him and turn him into a power plant. Now, that doesn't sound like a particularly good idea to me. That is too big of a threat to just have hanging around. If you're Doom, then whatever, right? You're arrogant enough to think, "I can defeat Galactus, and as powerful as he is, I can keep him under control." But the Fantastic Four is like, not a good idea, Doom. They think along the same lines as me, with Reed saying, "Victory shouldn't be doing this. This is really reckless, and it's wrong." And Doom says, "No, what was wrong is you invaded my sovereign nation." And Reed's like, what are you talking about? You couldn't even have accomplished this without us." And Doom's like, "Nah, I had contingency plans, as I always do for everything." And he pulls up one of the subatomic cannons and blasts the Fantastic Four, and they all get zapped. And Doom tells Victorious, "Sorry, couldn't be helped. They broke the laws of Latveria. I have no choice, and they've all been sentenced to death." And we get the "to be continued." So obviously they're going to survive. It's the Fantastic Four. They're not going to be executed, but it all plays into Doom's plans. He's the ultimate puppet master. This is why he, broadcasts his message out saying, "I got this under control. Don't anybody come and help us. Don't cross our borders under pain of death," because now it's out there, and the proof is been broadcast everywhere. Everybody saw the Fantastic Four cross their borders, went to Latveria to help fight against Galactus. And so Doom is within his legal right to try to kill him and or kill the Fantastic Four. But beyond that, you got to agree with Reed. Trying to turn Galactus into a source of energy for the entire planet, while if it works, great. That's a great idea, renewable energy. But oh my God, way too big of a risk. The risks don't outweigh the rewards in my mind on that one. So we'll have to wait and see what happens. All right, moving on. We're going to talk about Marvel Comics Presents number 2. This has 3 stories. There's a Wolverine story, the main story, written by Charles Soule, with pencils by Paulo Sequeira, and inks by Oren Jr. with colors by Frank Deramata and letters by Joe Caramagna. There's also a Reed Richards story and a Gorilla Man story, who I wasn't real familiar with. But let's start with the Wolverine story. It's 1954, Kansas. Wolverine's cruising around on a Harley, thinking back how it's been a decade since the Second World War was won. And Logan, like a lot of people, had done his best to put the horrors of the war behind him. And we did see some of those horrors last issue, where Logan had to end up fighting some demon called the Truth, and that demon slaughtered Logan's whole platoon, along with some civilians that were there as well. So Logan's thinking that, you know, America in the 50s, it's a pretty good place to be. You know, no invaders had actually set foot on the soil, and it doesn't carry a lot of the same scars that the rest of the world does from that war. And Logan's just kind of letting himself drift around through the wide spaces, and he was just enjoying life, basically. But he hadn't forgotten the truth, and that truth is with a capital T. And that truth is the name of the demon that Logan had fought. So while he's cruising along on his Harley, all of a sudden he's summoned, as it were, and he disappears, and he shows up in China at the Yangtze River Basin. And the voice that's narrating us tells us that my family brought that demon, the demon called the Truth, into the world 10 years back, and we banished him, but we knew he could return every 10 years. And he always returns at wherever the worst place in the world is, wherever the most tragedy is. And that would be why it showed up in World War II in Italy, where it showed up when Wolverine fought it last time. This time in 1954, it's choosing the side of the Yangtze River where it's overflowed its banks in central China. Official reports set the deaths at 30,000, but modern analysis says it's more like 200,000, and millions of people displaced, and homes and possessions destroyed, and the refugee population in China is currently larger than most countries. And at that moment, it definitely was the worst place in the world. So Wolverine is there, and, you know, falls into the river and swims up to the top of the river. And he's trying to figure out what's going on. And we see that Sylvie is there. She would be the 5-year-old whose mother was killed by the Truth. But, you know, their family, having been charged to banish this demon every 10 years when he shows up, and she ended up having to finish it because her mother died, and, you know, a really heroic act. And, you know, you give her a lot of credit for doing that when she was, you know, just a child. She's only 5 years old. And for whatever reason, because Logan was there, because he was the one that helped it happen, he's been charged to become the guardian, as it were. He's always there or he's always expected to be there to protect whoever the member of Sylvie's family is that's supposed to send this demon back. So, you know, Wolverine recognizes her, and she explains that it's about to happen again, how the truth is going to come, and somebody from her family has to complete the spell, and it's Wolverine's job to protect her, because Wolverine's the guardian. And Wolverine's like, but, you know, you're just a kid. She's like, well, I'm older than I was last time, and there's nobody else, right? I have to do this. So, you know, we set wards. We know the demon is going to be here soon. Will you help me? And Wolverine says, well, yeah, I won't let anything happen to you. I'll keep you safe. And Sylvie turns away and says, well, you didn't keep my mother safe, which isn't really fair. I mean, Wolverine at the time didn't even know what was going on. And so Wolverine realizes just how scared she really is. And at that moment, there's a portal that opens up, and we see the demon, the truth, start climbing through. And even though Sylvie spent the last 10 years preparing, nobody could prepare her for what it really would be like with the understanding she has at 15 years old that she couldn't have understood at five, how dangerous and terrifying that this is, right? And Wolverine's like, yeah, when you see this demon, your mouth fills with grave dirt and your secret heart screams and screams, and you feel like you'll never not be afraid ever again. And when you see the truth, all you want to do is run. And Sylvie's covering her mouth with her hands. She's like, I can't do this. I can't do this. I can't do this. And Wolverine's trying to calm her down, saying, listen, I won't let that thing touch you no matter how hard it fights me. I won't stop fighting for me. Just promise that you'll keep fighting too. And Sylvie says, you know what? I'm sorry. And she runs. And Wolverine's like, oh, crap. So Wolverine has no choice but to try to kill the truth, even though Sylvie's told him that it's not possible to kill this demon. All they can ever do is, you know, banish it for another 10 years. So Wolverine pops his claws, which at this time it's just bone claws. You know, he hasn't had the adamantium grafted to his skeleton at this point. And he tells the truth, you know, maybe there's no way to kill you, but I'm sure going to try. So there's a pretty epic fight. And, you know, just in terms of strength, this demon is much stronger than Wolverine. So he gets the upper hand relatively quickly. He's holding Logan under the water and trying to drown him. And Sylvie actually shows back up. So she found it within herself. She found some courage, and she uses her magical ability to blast the truth and throw him off of Wolverine. And she pulls Wolverine back up to the surface. And Wolverine's like, oh, you came back. And she's like, yeah, I'm sorry. I just got afraid. He's like, it's okay to be afraid. Like, don't say you're sorry. I'm scared too. But it's like you said, Sylvie, there's nobody else. And he says, so he's going to come back every 10 years. And Sylvie's like, yep, every 10. And there's really no way to kill this thing. And Sylvie's like, nope. And as the truth starts charging, Wolverine pops his claws again and says, we'll see. You know, and it's to be continued in the next issue. He is the best at what he does, which is kill things. And if anybody can kill this demon, it's going to be Logan. So I really like the story. It's super fast paced and a lot of action. I love the fact that Charles Soule gave us the sort of human and realistic side of this 15-year-old girl that, you know, she runs away. Here's her whole purpose for living, basically. You know, her family's charged with banishing this demon every 10 years. And she's been training for it, and she's been preparing, but, you know, like Wolverine himself said, it's not something you can really be prepared for, how you're actually going to feel when you're confronted with that demon. So to me, that's realistic. And it speaks to, the fact that she is just a 15-year-old girl. It makes sense. And it's great because it does show that at her core, she is heroic. At her core, she does honor her sense of duty and her obligation and responsibility and comes back. You know, she doesn't just leave Logan to fend for himself. So yeah, great story. The art is spectacular, really great colors. So Paulo Sequeira, I've seen his art before, and I'm always impressed with his line work and his storytelling. Frank DiArmada, this is probably the best color work I've seen him do before. And not that I've ever seen him do bad color work, but it's never stood out to me as good as it does in this one, especially all the magic. When Sylvie uses her powers, it glows and it pops right off the page. So really good visual story. Moving on to the Mr. Fantastic story. This one's written by Mark Waid, art by Jabril Morissette Fan, colors by Dan Brown, letters by Joe Caramagna. This art is not as clean, and it's almost like colored ink wash. So I got to think that's just based on the kind of the line work and the artwork that Dan Brown had to work with. And everything is colored very, very muted, very, I mean, heavy, heavy blacks. And so with the way everything was shaded, I don't think Dan Brown had a lot of room to play with color. And also, based on the fact that said in the past, maybe he did want to give it almost a sepia tone. So there's not really much to this story. I kind of feel like a little bit like, what's the point? I mean, it's Mark Waid, and he certainly is an excellent writer, and I'm a fan of him, but just kind of wonder who asked for this story. Like, was anybody asking for this story? And basically what it is, it's set in the mid-50s when the fifth space race was first going on between the United States and the Soviet Union. And the Soviet Union had just managed to launch Sputnik into space. And because of that, Reed Richards breaks up with Sue Storm. So I guess if anybody's asking for the story, or maybe people are just wondering, well, if Reed Richards was so smart, why wasn't he helping? Why didn't we get the first satellite into space and that sort of thing? I guess this is sort of the explanation of it. So basically, Ben comes and confronts Reed. He's been talking to Sue, and she told him that she broke up, and Reed is just disappointed. He's like, we should have been the first ones into space. It's my fault. I've been distracting myself. And, you know, now I have all these ideas for a new way to get us there. And nobody can say that I wasn't giving my all. And, you know, we have a prototype already, and it's experimental. And he's talking about all the things it can do. And as he's doing that, as he's explaining that to Ben Grimm, another scientist comes in and explains that two Russian saboteurs just showed up and stole the prototype. And Reed freaks out. No, it's irreplaceable. He goes chasing after him with Ben hot on his tail, going, what are you doing? I'm not a coward, but these guys, these saboteurs have guns. How about we let the armed soldiers handle it? Like, what are you doing, Reed? And Reed says, no, we can't wait. They might get away. And I was bored for a minute last week, and so I figured that there were 7 ways onto the base and only 3 ways to sneak off. And I told the base commander about it. And we did notice that one of the ways off, there's a small section of the perimeter fence that can only be seen at night by one searchlight. And earlier today, that searchlight stopped working. So now we know why. They must have sabotaged it. That's where they're going to escape. And Ben's like, okay, smart that you figured that out. But again, like, we're chasing after these guys that have pistols, and, you know, we have nothing. Like, what's going on? And that's when Reed confides in him, says, it's my fault. He's like, what's your fault? He's like, we should have been first into space. If I stayed in the lab where I belonged. And Ben's like, no. Speed's not everything. You need to have balance in your life. And Reed's like, no. The others, they don't believe in me. They don't even take me seriously. That's why you found me working alone. None of my peers believe in any of my designs. They say my stuff's too radical. It's too out there. They actually consider me inferior, Ben. Like, maybe they're right. Maybe I'm not as smart as I think I am. Like, what am I without my intelligence? I'm nobody. And Ben's like, man, why do you doubt yourself? And meanwhile, they catch up to the saboteurs. One of them's cutting through the fence, and the other's actually right next to him, about to shoot him. But Ben's able to get the drop on him while Reed goes after the other guy. And he's about to hop on a motorcycle and escape when Reed tackles him, but he pulls out his gun and starts firing at Reed. And Reed thinks, well, I don't really have a choice. He pulls a remote control out of his pocket and causes the prototype to explode. And Ben catches up to him and says, what was that? He's like, well, you remember earlier we were talking about what a great kid Sue's brother was, and how he liked to launch model rockets. And one of them, he even installed a prototype an explosive at, because he likes fireworks, and he wanted to blow the rocket up when it was at its highest point. Well, that gave me the idea basically to do the same, and to put a remote destruct mechanism in our prototype just in case it ever fell into the wrong hands. And Ben's like, well, you know, we lost the gizmo, but it's better than the Russians having it, right? And it does show how desperate the Russians are. And Reed says, you know what? Do you think it's too late to call Sue? And Ben's like shocked, like, wait a second. You were just talking about how you couldn't be distracted. And now you want to give her a call? And Reed says, yeah, I think you might be right. There's a clearly value to a work-life balance. Not every good idea comes from being surrounded by equations. And as he says that, we get a picture of the remote in his hand. So clearly thinking that, yeah, the fact that he had that relationship with Johnny and the fact that that he got the idea to plant an explosive device as a failsafe in the prototype was good. So elsewhere on the last page of the story, we find out that it was Dr. Doom that hired these Russians to go and try to steal the prototype. The Russians will be blamed for it, and nobody will know that it was Doom behind it after all. And Doom telling his lackey, you know, it's a pity Richard's mind is no match for my own, but there might have been one or two little useful ideas I could have gleaned from his invention. Because there are other worlds and other realms beyond this mortal veil, and Doom is not going to rest easily until he can And Victor Von Doom will not rest until he can effortlessly breach their barriers and take what he deems rightfully his. So again, I'm just not sure what the point of this was. Maybe just for people to say, well, why didn't Reed help out more with the space program? Because there is a little sort of historical note here at the end of the story that says, on March 31st, 1958, America launched Explorer number 1. Reed Richards was only marginally instrumental in its success, though he did glean from its findings a fact crucial to his future. It was the first spacecraft to determine that the Earth is surrounded by vast bands of radiation, those being the cosmic radiation that gave the Fantastic Four their powers. So, like I said, it's a fun story. I just kind of feel a little bit like, what's the point of it? Anyway, moving on to the last story. As I said, it's Gorilla Man, who I'm not very familiar with at all. It's written by David and Maria Lapham. David Lapham does the art, colors by Lee Luffridge, and letters by Joe Caramagna. Do get a little blurb here, which will tell you about as much as I know about Gorilla Man. It says, seeking immortality, mercenary soldier Kenneth Hale followed a tribal legend deep into the African jungle, unwittingly killed a mystical gorilla. He won his immortality at the cost of being transformed into a gorilla himself. So it starts off, and basically we're seeing this guy who's a gorilla man, for lack of a better way to put it. And he's thinking about how he learned of the legend of the Jabari Mountain clan, who protected themselves by summoning the spirit of this gorilla god, and that spirit would merge with one of their men as a champion, and they would be okay for a certain number of years, but eventually the gorilla god would overtake the man, turning him into a crazed beast, and he would then kind of start killing the ones he was supposed to protect. And at that point, he would try to consume the world. He threatened to become god of the earth, and it would be up to the tribe to seek out a new champion to defeat the old one and merge with the spirit again and again. And we see that Black Panther saying, this is how it's always been, Kenneth Hale, and why you must come back with me to Wakanda, because we're trying to save you from the same fate, right? We're trying to save you from being overcome by the gorilla god. So we see that Kenneth Hale in his gorilla man form, I guess you'd say, is flying with T'Challa, and they're landing at in Wakanda, and he has these we're not sure how the ritual starts, but there's some sort of ritual where Kenneth Hale in his gorilla man form has to sort of confront the other gorilla spirits. And so he in his mind he attacks Black Panther. I mean, it's really unclear. This story is kind of out there. And he's like seeing visions, and it's a city, and he jumps off and attacks Black Panther, who's standing on the wing of the ship that was flying in previously. And Gorilla Man like bites him in half as he's falling, and then falls into the jungle. And then is attacked by a bunch of gorillas. Again, I think the story's rough. It is. It's hard to explain. It's hard to understand exactly what's going on. Is this because again, we don't know how the ritual started. Like, and Black Panther even mentions when he needs to commune with his gods, he drinks the broth made from the heart shaped herb. That's not going to work for the Gorilla Man. But what does he do? I mean, is this like the equivalent of a peyote type hallucination or what? Is unclear. It's really unclear what's actually reality and what's not. And being that we had the actual scene in reality where Gorilla Man and T'Challa were flying in his ship and the rest of it is apparently just like a dreamscape. Yeah, it's really not done particularly well. But anyway, he bites Black Panther in half and then falls into the jungle where he's attacked by a bunch of other gorillas who basically rip his flesh from him. And underneath all the gorilla flesh is him, is Ken Hale, the mercenary, who for some reason has a flamethrower. Like when he falls into the forest, he's in his Gorilla Man form where he's a gorilla and he's wearing like regular human clothes. But, and even when he falls through the trees, we see him in that form. But then when he lands and gets up, he's got a flamethrower on his back, like a backpack flamethrower. And even though all these gorillas attack him and rip off all his gorilla flesh to where he's just a man, he still has the flamethrower pack on, which wouldn't make any sense because you just ripped it off along with all his gorilla flesh. But dreamscape, I guess. So he fires off the flamethrower and gets all the gorillas to sort of flee. And he yells out, "You there, T'Challa? Sorry, I bit you in half." And all of a sudden he's in this clearing and there's some giant gorillas in some armor. And there's a big gorilla statue. And he sort of walks toward the gorilla statue where there's, I guess, the leader of the gorillas. And he thinks, okay, I get it. This is the ghost of all the gorilla champions past. And you were all like me at one point, or at least how I'm supposed to be. So let's do this. And he goes up to the altar, as it were, where there's this huge gorilla. I mean, gorilla's 10 times, if not more, larger than him. And so he takes off the flamethrower, drops on the ground and says, okay, you're the gorilla god, right? And I gotta fight you now. Gotta earn my stripes back. So yeah, let's do this. And he runs up and he tries to attack one of the gorilla's legs and he can't even wrap his arms around it, but he just kind of grabs on it and the gorilla just backhands him, just flicks him away and he goes flying. He's clearly no match for this gorilla. And he's like, okay, but I've done this before. I've defeated you before. And he walks back up toward the gorilla and the gorilla again, just gives him a backhand a couple more times. And he's laying there on the ground at the feet of the gorilla and he says, okay, then come on, just get it over with. You know, I can't beat you. And then the gorilla looks up and, or stands up and walks over to him and looks down and goes, oh, wait, I get it. It was your strength. And then that gorilla disappears in a puff of smoke, fire, flame, what have you. And we see, T'Challa and Gorilla Man are then sitting around the fire back wherever this peyote or whatever Gorilla Man took to go on this dream journey or whatever. And T'Challa is saying, yeah, I was scared for you. But yeah, you learned a lesson. You made it through. And he said, yeah, one day my time will be up, but that's not what today was. This was a lesson, a big, hard, painful lesson. It was never about fighting the gorilla god. It was about embracing the gorilla spirit. And I never knew I was part of something so big. And that's how the story ends. So in my mind, this is not a good story. How did he learn anything? He got smacked down by the gorilla a couple times. And then all of a sudden he just says, oh, it was your strength. Like what? Like what? What happened that made him realize anything? He just got his butt kicked and then they just said, okay, you're still the gorilla man. Like, I don't know. You want to talk about the middle story being, I don't get it. Like, I don't get what the point of that is. I really don't get what the point of this Gorilla Man story is. Like, I've read it three times and I still don't think I really understand it. And who exactly is asking for a Gorilla Man story? Maybe I'm one of the few comic fans who doesn't really care about gorillas. I mean, I hear other people talking about gorilla stories. They even did DC did that JL Ape crossover years ago. People go crazy for it. I really couldn't care less about monkeys or apes or whatever. I guess I'm in the minority there, but yeah, I didn't understand the story. Didn't make sense to me. Art wasn't particularly good. Yeah, I definitely could have done without it. So kind of hard to even recommend this, the story. It does have a really cool, or recommend this issue, I should say. It does have a really cool Marvel looking cover for the front cover. Very, you know, Marvel-esque with Wolverine and Mr. Fantastic, and even Gorilla Man looks cool here because he's drawn by Art Adams. And if anybody knows how to draw apes that look really good, it's Art Adams. You know, the Monkey Man and O'Brien series that he did the art for is spectacular. So, and the Wolverine story is really good, but I don't know that I can say that it's worth the price of admission, because the Mr. Fantastic story is okay. And honestly, that Gorilla Man story is awful. So take from that what you will. All right, let's move on to the last book that I'm going to talk about. It's Daredevil number 24. This is from the 2017, or I actually think it started in 2015. But it's from the Charles Soule run, the one that we've been covering on these Marvel Monday episodes for a long time, starting with issue 1. We're up to issue 24. As I said, written by Charles Soule. The art is by Alec Morgan, colors by Matt Milla, and letters by Clayton Cowles. And I'll just read you the blurb inside the front cover and kind of remind you of where we are in this Supreme story that's been going on. So Matt Murdock won his first victory in the New York State Supreme Court, having convinced the court to allow Daredevil to testify as a witness without revealing his true identity, which, unbeknownst to the world at large, is actually Matt Murdock. A precedent was set that could legitimize superheroes involving themselves in the legal process. But there are those that are unhappy with Matt's agenda. Among them, Wilson Fisk, a.k.a. the Kingpin, who has begun a two-pronged strike against Matt. Fisk has secretly hired the expert known only as Legal to fight Matt Murdock in court, while simultaneously engaging Tombstone as Plan B to snuff out Murdock on the streets. Matt Murdock has no choice but to press on. So starts off Supreme Part 4, and the DA, Matt Murdock's boss, is looking at an issue of the Daily Bugle saying this is unacceptable. On the front of the Daily Bugle, it says Matt Murdock loser. Assistant District Attorney Matt Murdock drops the ball at State Court of Appeals. So you can only imagine that DA Hochberg is pretty upset at Matt, and he's calling him out on it, saying, look, you know, you told me this was going to work, and now, you know, you lost, and we're not looking good right now. Everybody's calling me, and I'm in a bad position, you know? And, well, actually, it puts you in a bad position. Because it's not so much the loss, like everybody loses, but it's the spectacle of it, right? And the fact that it involves superheroes, and it's, you put a vigilante on the stand, and I can't even believe that, you know, you convinced me to let you do it. And if it had worked, that would have been one thing. And Matt's like, hold on, you know, we can still appeal this. There's another level. We can take it all the way to the top. And he's like, wait, you mean the Supreme Court? And Matt's like, yeah, it was, I won at the trial level. We even won the first appeal, and it was only the second appeal that it got overturned, and it was 4-3. It wasn't like it was a slam dunk. And Hochberg's like, man, you're serious. If you could pull this off, yeah, it would turn everything around. But listen, you do this, you're on your own. You know, no DA resources, none of the personnel. As far as this office is concerned, you have no friends. You're going to have to pull this off on your own. So meanwhile, the Kingpin is talking to the legal expert he hired, who just refers to himself as legal, as in I am legal. And Kingpin's pretty impressed. He's like, oh, you actually beat Matt Murdock. I had my doubts, but you did well. Looks like the law was on my side. And legal's like, no, Mr. Fisk, that's not correct. The law's on no one's side. It's it can be used to support any position. If the attorney making the argument is sufficiently skilled, the law is an abstraction. It's a tool. It's an instrument to be played. And Mr. Murdock and I were both virtuosos, but the justice system just happened to like my song more this time. And Fisk is like, well, if the law's not on my side, but you are, aren't I lucky? Because, you know, luck doesn't have anything to do with it, Mr. Fisk. You're my client. And until you're not, I am, quote unquote, on your side. Speaking of which, I'll be off. I've finished the service I've been hired to do, and you'll have my invoice soon. And Fisk is like, legal, did I say you could leave? Legal's a little taken aback, like, you did not. Is there something else? He said, look, I told you when I hired you, I know the law. You beat Matt Murdock on the Court of Appeals. That's the highest state court. Well, what about federal? And legal's like, well, he could file a petition with the Supreme Court, but that'd be a desperate move. It'd require an exceptional legal mind to even have the slightest chance of success. And Kingpin said, a legal virtuoso, you might say. And legal gets where he's going. He's like, ah, yes, a virtuoso. So no, it's not over. And legal's like, I think it's unlikely, extremely unlikely that he'll go any farther. And Kingpin, I love this line. He says, extremely unlikely is exactly where Matt Murdock lives. You beat him once. Can you do it again? He says, like, of course, if necessary. And Kingpin says, okay, that's all I need to know. You can leave. So meanwhile, Wesley comes in, and Kingpin asks for an update on Plan B. And he says, okay, we'll remind Tombstone that his contract remains incomplete and all benefits and penalties remain in full effect. So the scene then shifts to Hell's Kitchen. We see Foggy and his girlfriend heading to a local bar, and they're kind of bickering back and forth about what a hole in the wall kind of rundown joint it is. And Matt Murdock actually shows up saying, hey, Foggy, hope I'm not interrupting. He goes, well, you kind of are. And Alina, Foggy's girlfriend's like, no, it's fine. This is him, right? The one you're always talking about, the one you call a... Foggy's like, no. He's got excellent hearing. Don't need to remind him of my choice remarks. She goes, fine. I'm going to go home. I need to take a bath and wash this place off me anyway. Why don't you come over later and you can join me? So she leaves, and Matt's kind of congratulating Foggy. Hey, she seems great. And Foggy's like, yeah, she is. You'd be amazed how much your life improves when you stop being best friends for a superhero. Why are you here, Matt? He's like, well, somebody told me that not long ago. I don't have any friends. I thought I might prove them wrong. And again, Foggy's really still so ticked off at Matt. He says, yeah, good luck with that. And orders a beer. So again, he's like, what are you doing here? And how did you even know I was here? And Matt says, well, it wasn't rocket science. There's free hot dogs at two blocks from your place. So I figure you're probably here three nights a week. And since you aren't answering my calls, I thought I'd come by. And I guess I got lucky. You know, you're here the first time I came by and checked. And Foggy says, you know, I'm here six nights a week, pal. So you would have had to get lucky for me not to be here. So you're here because of the case, right? The Slagansky trial. And Matt's like, well, you heard about that? And he's like, of course, everybody's heard about it. You're a laughingstock. What were you thinking? And Matt says, you know, my case was solid. And three of the seven judges on appeal thought so. And Foggy's like, it was solid? You thought that putting your costume on and putting yourself on the witness stand was a good idea? You screwed up an easy conviction because you wanted to pursue some dumb idea about Daredevil testifying, which, by the way, goes against the oath you took as a lawyer. And Matt's like, I haven't lost yet. And he's like, are you kidding me? Are you talking about the Supreme Court? they don't even listen to hardly any cases, less than 1%. And Matt says, you know, they've never heard one of our cases. He goes, wait, ours? You want me to help you write the petition to the Supreme Court? He's like, look, I can see both sides, Matt, right? You and Daredevil. And there was the thing with the 10-finger guy in Chinatown, and then that serial killer Muse, and then your friend Blindspot. Yeah, how's he doing, by the way, right? Don't hear much about him anymore. You know, it's a new costume you're wearing, but it's the same old crap. You know, you started your life over when the Purple Children gave you back your identity. And the thing is, Matt, so did I. And nobody's tried to kill me for months. And I like my life without Daredevil. Maybe you should too. Maybe you should just try it. And Matt's like, I'm saving lives, Foggy. It's what I'm meant to do. And I'm trying to do it better this time. I'm trying to do it right. And that's what this case is about. And Foggy says, you know, you should ask yourself one question. Who's your worst enemy? And Matt thinks about it for a second. And this is a great scene, by the way. He says, well, I guess Wilson Fisk, Bullseye, Purple Man, The Hand, Typhoid Mary, that serial killer you mentioned, Muse. You know, I'm pretty worried about him. And Foggy says, you know, you're missing one, bud. He's like, who are you talking about? Frank Castle? Elektra? I guess maybe. And then Foggy says, Tombstone. And Matt's like, no, Lonnie Lincoln? He wishes. I just saw him. He tried to, and the whole reason Foggy said that is because Tombstone has just walked into the bar. So he yells out Murdoch. And Tombstone's got a couple of armed thugs with him. And they're like, hey, do you want us to pop him? Tombstone, no, I'll take care of him. You just make sure he doesn't leave. Guard the door. So Matt grabs Foggy, pushes him behind him, and says, all right, call 911. He's like, don't take too long. He's going to tear us apart by the time they get here. He's like, no. Matt says, no, I'll buy us some time. What, are you going to run to the bathroom and change? He's like, no. Wet paper plus fire equals smoke. And he pours Foggy's beer on the newspaper, tosses it on the grill that has the hot dogs, and the whole bar fills up with smoke, which allows Matt to take out most of the thugs by hitting them in the face with billiard balls. And he takes a pull cue and snaps it over his knee and pretty much beats the crap out of Tombstone, which delays them from and again, they don't even realize it's Matt Murdock that's fighting him and not Daredevil. But it keeps them busy long enough for the cops to show up. And once the cops show up and they hear the sirens, they take off running. So a few minutes after that, Foggy and Matt are sitting out on the curb, and Foggy's asking him, so what's the deal with Tombstone? Does he know you're Daredevil or something? And Matt says, no, I don't think so. This is actually a Matt Murdock thing. You know, he attacked me and Jen Walters at a lawyer bar a couple of nights ago. And it could be a grudge, an old grudge, I guess. But what it feels like is someone wants me to drop the Slagansky case. Probably the same person who hired this guy legal to take over the defense. So you know what that tells me? Someone's scared. And I get what we're getting at earlier, Foggy. You're trying to say that I'm my own worst enemy, and maybe that's true. I don't know. It's hard to tell sometimes, but I don't see myself the way other people do. You know, when I look into a mirror, it's just a piece of glass to me. There's nobody looking back. I can't see myself there. And you know, I think Daredevil is one of the very best things I do, one of the most important parts of my life. And I know to you, he's an obsession that's ruined my life. And I think in a way, we're both right. I am my own worst enemy, and that's why I could use a friend. And Foggy says, well, look, getting a case in front of the Supreme Court is every lawyer's dream. And if you actually won, it would really be the kind of change that could make a difference, something we worked for our whole careers, right? Like the kind of thing we used to talk about in law school, making a real difference. And all of that's true, but the one question that I really need you to answer, Matt, after everything that's gone on, is why should I help you? And Matt thinks about it for a second. He says, because I'm sorry for everything, for all of it. you know, he's apologized for everything he's put Foggy through over the years. And Foggy reaches out and puts his hand on Matt's shoulder and says, well, it took you long enough. And he stands up and he offers his hand to Matt so Matt can grab it and stand up as well. And he says, okay, I'll help you. It doesn't mean everything's fixed between us. And it doesn't mean I've changed my mind. And I think you're making the right choices, Matt. But considering that you will now have my considerable legal expertise at your side, it does mean one thing. And Matt says, what's that? And I love Foggy's response. He says, pal, you're going to the Supreme Court. And to be continued next issue. So great issue. I gotta love the relationship of Matt and Foggy. And I love that Charles didn't make it easy for Matt. You know, it wasn't just a case where they've been friends forever and they're going to stay friends. And Foggy knows Matt's, you know, at his core, a good person, and he's going to forgive him for everything he's done. You know, it sucked for Foggy when he had forgotten that Matt was Daredevil, and Matt immediately just went over and spilled the beans again. You know, it could have been a burden lifted off of Foggy. You know, Foggy was kind of mad about that because Daredevil didn't, and Matt didn't go and tell Krista McDuffie, his girlfriend that he lived with. You know, he's like, no, I didn't want to burden her with that. I wanted to protect her. Well, he thought about that as far as Kristen went, but not Foggy. Foggy got the baggage back right away. So you can totally understand where he's coming from there. And I know this is a little bit of a down issue in terms of doesn't advance the story that much, but sort of explains a lot of things and sets the stage for the next issue and what's to come. So I think it is a good issue because it does focus on Matt and Foggy's relationship, and I do enjoy that. And it gives us some perspective of where the Kingpin's coming from with legal and that sort of thing. As far as the art goes, I'm not a big fan of Alec Morgan doing superhero comics. I think he's better suited for other things, crime noir, that sort of thing. And I know this is sort of a crime noir comic, but I mean, I really don't care for the way he draws Tombstone, especially. So the art's okay. I think the color work that Matt Miller does is where it keeps consistency from issue to issue, because I'm pretty sure Matt Miller colors all the issues that Charles Soule wrote. And so it does have a consistency of tone that way. But I'm just not a big fan of the way he draws Matt or Tombstone or Foggy for that matter. He has some really thick lines, really thick eyebrows. Tombstone just looks weird to me. Kind of looks, his face is very porcine, like a pig. So yeah, I mean, the art's okay. It's not great. It's not terrible, but I've definitely seen better work from Alec, and it doesn't work for me that well here. So, but it's a minor nitpick. Like I said, it's overall a great story, and there's not a lot of action. I mean, we have the bar fight, but that's pretty short. And Alec handles the action scenes fine. It's probably the best art in the book, actually, especially color wise. So that's fine. But you know, I know it's challenging when it's just a bunch of talking head scenes to keep the art interesting. And he does move the camera around, and the transitions are fine. Mostly it's the line work and the anatomy and the rendering that I don't really care for. So, but again, it's not, it doesn't ruin the issue or pull me out of the story or anything. It's just when I go back through and look at it with a more critical eye, it just, I don't know, just certain, it's just not my favorite style, basically what it comes down to. So, anyway, that's going to do it for this episode, everybody. Hope you enjoyed the Marvel Monday, as it were. I do want to remind everybody that coming up in just a couple days on our Kickstarter Spotlight Wednesday, we'll be talking to Liam Sharp about his current campaign for a Jack Katz hardback with a bunch of Jack's previously unpublished work. It's a very worthy cause to put some money in Jack's pocket. This guy's been working in comics for 8 decades. So, you know, that's a huge accomplishment, and he could definitely use our help. And you owe it to yourself to at least go and check out the campaign, because the art is incredible. I can't believe I didn't know more about Jack or seen his artwork before. I can't wait to get my hands on the book myself. It's just amazing, amazing work. And the fact that we get to celebrate it while he's still around, albeit at 93 years of age, is great. I think that's wonderful. You know, so often these guys from his era, we celebrate them on their birthdays and whatnot, but they're not here anymore. And the fact that we get to do this and Jack himself gets to reap the rewards, I think is really worthwhile. So it was a great conversation with Liam. He explains about meeting Jack and becoming friends with them and discovering all this, this treasure trove of artwork in Jack's house. So, listen to the episode, go check out the campaign. I think it's very much worth your time if you're an aspiring comic artist or just a fan of comic artwork. So thanks for going and checking it out. And even if you don't pledge, it's not your thing, or you don't have the means, please just share it on social media so we can get the word out to as many people as possible. So once again, I want to thank everybody for listening, and we'll talk to you next time. You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.